Thank you, Dr. Hook, and it's always good to have our sessions ending with people leaving with questions and PhD theses. So we had hoped to have a dialogue, kind of an Oprah-style event at the end, because we realize this meeting has been packed, filled with information, lots of good conversations. We know everyone is exhausted. So we are going to have two people presenting questions and discussing. I will always be interrupting as usual. And I'd like to introduce our two speakers. One probably goes without introduction is Dr. David Lewis, who is my co-chair for this meeting. And he heads the Center for HIV, STDs, and the Institute of Communicable Diseases. And we also have Dr. Jonathan Merman, who is the Center Director for the Center of HIV, Viral Hepatitis, STDs, TB, and Division of Adolescent School Health. He is my boss. So we're really excited he had the time to come today to really sort of pose questions and increase the dialogue around STI prevention. So we are going to, are we sitting in chairs or are we standing here? I think we're going to stand here because of we have one microphone.
Thanks to Jamie DeKleiter, we have two now.
Okay, all right. Can we have the first slide?
There we go.
Okay, that's great. So thank you. Thanks very much. So I was going to provide some international questions. I think real challenges that we see on a global level. And my first question really was about what are the barriers to STI surveillance in resource-poor settings. And this comes partly because I work in a surveillance center and partly because I've had a lot of experience, I think, in Africa now where we're really struggling with lack of data. So that was my question. Do you want me to give you some of my thoughts?
You can give some thoughts and we can discuss.
Okay. Cool. So I think the pictures, I try to use pictures so you get an idea of kind of what's going on. So I think the first thing is the infrastructure of the laboratories in many parts of the world have collapsed, particularly in those countries where syndromic management has been used for over a decade. We've empowered nurses to deal with patients as they come into clinics on the basis of their symptoms, but we've said no need to take specimens, and that has actually disempowered laboratory staff. So I know from my own experience in South Africa, when we try and get gonococcal culture done, which is a relatively simple task, when we go to peripheral labs in big cities across the country, we have sensitivities of down to 30 or 40% compared to molecular assays. Whereas in the big centers, the big universities, we're still hitting around 90% sensitivity. So we have a real problem. The next thing is the capacity, so it's training of staff and keeping people in jobs, and a lot of people are moving into private sector following better money. So there's a big need for laboratory strengthening across many parts of the poorer regions of the world. And then I think another issue is my ethics picture here, and this is because in South Africa and other African countries I've worked in, we have to go through the ethics committee to actually take the samples now, because the standard of care has become doing nothing. So when we actually want to take a specimen to test, it's doing something over and above standard of care. And so that now needs a long procedure of informed consent forms and so forth. And that makes it very difficult, first of all, to get consecutive samples, and secondly, to find staff who have time to actually do the work. So we have to employ extra nurses. So this is a major challenge. And how can we get departments of health in resource-poor settings to understand surveillance should be a public health function and should be part of the care and not something as a research project? And my final issue, I think, is about the clinicians. You can see at the bottom, that's a doctor in Madagascar having to be taught how to take a urethral swab and put it onto an agar plate because he has never done it before. Their nurses there being trained on how to fill in a questionnaire, one-page questionnaire, and how to label specimens. And you may think this is a relatively simple thing. We're currently doing a survey at the moment, and we had 6 specimens all came in with the same number. stuck on them for six different patients. So it is constantly a challenge for us to deal with the basic things and repeat the training. So that, I think translation, finally, the translation into action is the last big issue for Department of Health to act on the surveillance and that culture of thinking that way.
This is where we're going to have trouble. I was going to just make one quick comment about the United States, because you may think that we're well-resourced for our surveillance, but the history of infectious disease surveillance in the United States is it has relied on the clinical healthcare system. We rarely pay for our surveillance, so we are also struggling and pretty much have a diagnostic testing surveillance. We only are measuring cases among people who access care, who get tested, and have a laboratory or provider who performs. So we really also need to look at the surveillance we're doing in the United States. I think we have room for improvement.
Thank you. I think we decided what we would do is go through our questions. Gail will comment quickly after each one, and then in the end we'll open up to the audience. But I did want to start out by just with a theoretical question for Gail, which is, why are we here at all? Abstinence, monogamy with a partner who does not have an STD, and universal condom use are 100% effective in preventing STDs. People don't get STDs if they don't have sex. So these actions work perfectly if practiced.
Would you like a response, Dr. Merman?
But in the United States, 80% of all cases of reportable diseases are STDs. And life in practice is different than life planned. And because of that, I believe that most of the questions put before us today for public health are ones of implementation and applied science. How can we do the best job with the resources we have and develop new tools that will make us more effective? So what is the new generation of sexual risk messaging? And I ask this question assuming that everyone in the room realizes that times have changed, and deep in your heart, late at night, you question whether we are still providing the most effective messaging. The concept of protection is no longer restricted to the use of condoms during intercourse. PrEP reduces risk of HIV acquisition. ART reduces risk of HIV transmission. And people are embracing these effective methods for reducing HIV acquisition and reducing the use of condoms. But the availability of these methods for HIV reduction probably has increased the incidence of at least some STDs. Except for condoms, reduction in partners, and participating in less risky sex acts, STD and HIV prevention have started to diverge. Syphilis rates have doubled in the last 10 years. 91% are among men, and half are among gay and bisexual men with HIV infection. Yet no studies have assessed the effectiveness of STD and HIV risk reduction approaches incorporating STD screening and treatment, ART use by one's partner, PrEP, non-occupational post-exposure prophylaxis, and potentially seroadaptation. Given the increased use of these interventions and their potential for dramatic reductions in HIV risk, but also dramatic increases in STD risk, we need to do this. Otherwise, people hearing our prevention messages will instantly know that we're out of date, we'll lose our credibility, and our efforts will be ineffective. But my question is, what is our message? Quadruple protection? Condom use? Long-acting reversible contraception? Get an HPV vaccine and PrEP? I mean, we need help. And I believe David or someone from the audience is likely to know the answer.
And I don't have the answer as the director of the Division of STD Control, so we are looking to all of us to be answering this question because it's probably one of the most important things that we need to deal with today in the field of STIs.
Okay, so in the conference we've had a lot of talk about HPV and an excellent debate yesterday about school-based programs. So my question really facing much of the world is what are the challenges going to be faced in rolling out HPV vaccination in those countries at high risk for cervical cancer? And you can see from the map that we're really talking now about India, we're talking about much of sub-Saharan Africa and Latin America. And we had a very excellent talk from Gina Ogilvie about the usefulness of two-dose vaccines in young children under 15 and how that would be more cost-effective. Certainly in South Africa, I can tell you we've now moved to a two-dose regimen, and it fits better into our into a school-based program, which the government's about to start, but still has a lot of challenges because it doesn't have the money to pay for the vaccine in all of the schools. So we've been talking about doing it only in some in the lower-resourced schools. So a big issue really is if you go for a school-based program, which many people support, how do you get the kids to have the access? And we heard problems yesterday, I think, for the states as well. Kids are away the day of the vaccination. We all remember what it was like when we were young. That was the day we had a headache or something else and we didn't want to go to school. How do we deal with the out-of-school children? And again, that's a big issue. If you think about Africa, many young girls are not at school. They're at home looking after other children to support the family. So that's big issues for us. And then, again, monitoring and surveillance, because we don't really have a system in place, and it costs a lot of money to put these systems into resource-poor countries. So we do have a lot of challenges, but we know that cervical cancer is a major killer and the number one cause of death from cancer in women in Africa. So we do need to push on with this. And I think we follow examples like Rwanda, which have done really, really well. And we have to look at the good examples. I think you've heard some other countries in this meeting. I hope that for the US program, you'll be able to hear some things that have been working and maybe start to look afresh at perhaps ways of taking this challenge forward.
I agree, and it was a fantastic debate. It was actually a participatory debate for the HPV session, so I think we all enjoyed it.
Great. Thanks. So my next question is, how can we best leverage the healthcare system, the Affordable Care Act, and other programs for STD prevention? And to clarify, I've been asked to do more of the domestic focus than David, the global focus, although I think the concept of systems and changing them to make things better is important for everywhere. So the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, it would create opportunities and challenges for public health. We know we need safety net services for STDs, but it will also occur probably in a different form in some places. For example, there's never been as much alignment between CDC and U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommendations on screening, and the guidelines are relatively simple. For chlamydia and gonorrhea, annually screen sexually active women 24 years and younger, and anyone at increased risk. For hepatitis C, one-time screening for baby boomers and other people at risk. For HIV, screen persons 15 to 65 years of age, and then people at increased risk. But only a small proportion of people in the country who meet these criteria have ever been tested. Hopefully the fact that all of these recommendations have received a grade A or B recommendation from the task force and therefore will be reimbursed with no copay by individuals will increase their implementation. But at the same time, we have challenging times for prevention. And the last time I was at this conference, it was really the same situation. We have, you know, in the federal deficit was over $1 trillion in fiscal year 2013. There is a three-year freeze on federal discretionary spending and budgets, certainly for Gail's division, have not changed. There have been several years of reductions in public health services, and over 50,000 public health workers have lost their jobs over the past 5 years. But there's also been new scientific breakthroughs, and to some extent with the changes in the healthcare system that particularly affect people who have been uninsured or are medically underserved, provide, you know, opportunities for covering millions more people. So I'm reminded of the core functions of public health assessment, including surveillance, policy development, and assurance of implementation and outcomes. And in most areas of STDs, we have been heavily involved in the implementation of care and prevention services. But the Affordable Care Act also provides the opportunity to think of effective policy and monitoring the implementation of care by others. For example, ensuring easy access and reimbursement for substance abuse treatment and mental health services, enabling reimbursement for behavioral interventions and other task force approved prevention interventions, and supporting clinical decision tools for screening in clinical situations. There are several specific issues, like the preventive services rated A or B by the task force are covered with no copay by Medicaid expansion plans, and they include behavioral counseling for STD prevention. And the recent Medicaid final rule defines preventive services as services recommended by licensed practitioners. So there's a potential flexibility for reimbursement of services provided by health departments and community-based organizations. And also included as a reimbursable item is coordination of services to improve outcomes, such as work done by community-based organizations. And lastly, annual STD screening of persons with HIV treats and prevents STDs and HIV. And identification of people, particularly gay men who have STDs, provides an opportunity for identifying people at high risk for HIV acquisition and potential candidates for PrEP and other intensive interventions. So there's a synergy between STDs and HIV that can be expanded with under the Affordable Care Act. We will be challenged to do this right if we don't maintain STD clinics with the expertise and a welcoming environment for all people who are at high risk for STDs, and also assure quality services elsewhere.
So my short comment, because we've got so many good questions and I'm concerned about the time. I think, as our grantees know, we feel that we really have to take advantage of leveraging the new healthcare system in the United States. We recently completed a safety net analysis where we are estimating the number of uninsured, we're just talking about uninsured vulnerable populations in the United States just for chlamydia screening. The cost to do that annually is $240 million. My current budget is $140 million. So we're never going to be able to scale up our known effective interventions in the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force if we, as public health leaders, are not working with the healthcare system leaders to ensure that this happens for the patients in need.
So I'm going to make this a short one, but this conference for me, I will probably remember this for the most number of talks on congenital syphilis that I've ever been to. It's been phenomenal with the Latin American contingent that have come up from the South to tell us about all the hard work that's being done, the success, and the fact that we have rapid tests for syphilis available for treponemal antibodies, and also now the dual tests with HIV and all that that can do to integrate programs for maternal and child health with HIV and syphilis testing. However, I mean, the one thing I also will remember is the wonderful story of the cascade that Patty gave us in her plenary, and Charlotte reiterated it this morning at the breakfast symposium. And that cascade, we know a lot about it from HIV, but it's extremely important too in the context of syphilis. And basically, you know, you can have rapid tests and good tools to use, but if women are not booking in early, and if they're not being tested by the nurses, these tools are actually wasted. So we have huge amounts to do there to make sure we don't have stockouts of drugs, and to make sure that we're checking what's happening in terms of, again, surveillance and monitoring. We're going to lose RPR, antenatal screening surveillance. For example, South Africa is another country. It stopped it 2 years ago. Now the country's been asked by WHO, how close are we to elimination of congenital syphilis in the country? Nobody can tell them now because we haven't got any data. And the rapid test results are hidden in some books in the clinic. So we need a system that we somehow can get access to these results. And also notification of congenital syphilis, very important, but often not done well by clinicians. So we have tools, we have processes, we can certainly go and do this. We just need to get organized and perhaps follow the Latin American example and the enthusiasm that comes from that part of the world.
In the United States, because of our levels of resources, we really had to prioritize for our programs. So we're asking our programs to prioritize the burden of STIs among young people, the burden of STIs among men who have sex with men, mitigating the threat of resistant gonorrhea, and lastly, the elimination of congenital syphilis. We have the tools in this country to do this. In my opinion, if you have a case of congenital syphilis in your area, it is a sentinel event. It means the health department has failed and the healthcare system has failed. So we really think this is achievable in the United States.
Thank you. So how can we make the healthy choice easy? So the concept of nudging people to make healthier decisions has been mainly explored in the sphere of chronic diseases, and I want to raise it here. For chronic diseases, the healthier options are put into vending machines so people don't snack on fat, smoke-free buildings so that people don't have to go outside to smoke, and so they're going to reduce smoking, sidewalks for pedestrians so walking is comfortable and easy, and airbags so people are safer in a car crash. But I think we should consciously work toward making the default options safer for preventing infectious diseases as well. And some examples of this could include research to develop an effective microbicide for vaginal and anal sex, so inexpensive and safe enough to be in all lubricants and condoms. easy availability of non-reusable syringes, continued research for rapid treponemal and non-treponemal test, a multiplex PCR for all our infections of interest, or metagenomic tests for all STDs that comes with concomitant data on resistance, such as GeneXpert can do for tuberculosis. Or ultimately, the holy grail for safe sex, making a condom feel better than the alternative so that adherence is easy. In a national sample, greater than 70% of adolescents reported condom use during last sex. However, only 22% of women and 25% of men of all ages reported condom use. So why? Use of condoms is more than twice as likely with casual than a relationship partner, and couples stop using condoms over time. Men and women were over five times less likely to use a condom if they had had sex more than 10 times previously. And even among gay and bisexual men, 68% of HIV transmission was from a main partner, primarily because they had higher numbers of sex acts, more frequent receptive roles in anal sex, and lower condom use with main partners. So we need improved technology. And the Gates Foundation recently awarded $1 million, you know, kind of in research grants to develop a condom that, quote, significantly preserves or enhances pleasure, unquote. And one grantee, the University of Manchester, is exploring a graphene condom. Graphene's a remarkable substance consisting of a single layer of hexagonally bonded carbon atoms that is 1 million times thinner than paper and exceptionally strong. But given the importance of the issue, if not the technological challenge, creating a condom that feels good should be an area of continued effort. Ultimately, when it is truly pleasurable or at least easy to practice safe sex, it will be done. What are the scientific breakthroughs that will allow the safest choice to be the easiest choice for STDs?
Hear, hear.
So I'm going to make this my last one. And again, I guess coming from the African continent, it's something that we feel very strong about in some of the countries. So it's ironic that South Africa has probably some of the most liberal laws in the country. We have gay marriages and so forth. And yet we have problems here in Nigeria. You can see Uganda. But it seems to be that this tide of increased criminalization is spreading further and further across the world. And you've got problems now in Russia and also executions in Iran. And these are just four of many countries where we've got problems with criminalization. And those that don't have criminalization also have a lot of problems with stigma. So I have no easy answers for that. I don't think anybody will hear, and I'm probably preaching to the converted. But what I would say is that advocacy is very important for us and for our organizations. And we really need to influence politicians the best we can, because it's the politics that really helps push these things in the right direction. And organizations like WHO and UNAIDS as well, I would like myself to see stronger voices coming forward to talk about the importance of health that's being really disallowed to many people because they can't access the sort of services that they need to stay in a healthy sexual lifestyle.
And I'm really glad you brought this topic up. I think it's something that is discussed in sort of quiet rooms in the United States. We have a lot of laws that still can lead to criminalization of certain people infected with HIV. So I think we need to have discussions in this country as well.
Thanks. So my last question is, what's the best use of limited resources to reduce sexually transmitted diseases? The ultimate prevention for negatives is a vaccine. The ultimate prevention for positives is a cure. But unlike smallpox and polio, viruses that have been or will be eradicated solely through the use of a vaccine, or rinderpest and onchocerciasis, which either have or will be eradicated primarily through treatment, most STDs, perhaps HPV excepted, will require both direct prevention activities and effective treatment. So we have to ask ourselves, what is the best use of resources to reduce disease incidence in the U.S. and globally? Hundreds of millions of dollars are spent each year to prevent and treat STDs, yet it's not clear that these resources are always focused on the most cost-effective interventions or that they're having the largest possible impact that we hope for. But STDs do matter from disease incidence and cost perspectives. In the U.S. alone, there are millions of new cases of STDs, and the healthcare costs of these infections are considerable. For example, in 2013, of the eight common STDs, chlamydia, gonorrhea, hep B, herpes, simplex virus 2, HPV, syphilis, and trich, there are more than 19 million new infections each year, and their estimated total direct medical costs are over $3 billion. That's not even including HIV. So there are a plethora of options for us: screening, targeted testing and treatment, vaccination, social media campaigns, intensive behavioral counseling, contact tracing, new guidelines. How do we choose what to do? And I think resource allocation modeling can help us identify the highest impact prevention strategies by showing how to divide scarce STD dollars in a way that achieves the most impact at the lowest cost. It can't be everything, because letting 1,000 flowers bloom and combining interventions is not enough. All effective interventions are not equal. We need to prioritize. And this is a necessary but very difficult task. Since we have limited resources, maximizing prevention is going to be tough. But we should be able to determine the feasibility of full-scale implementation of any intervention that we have evaluated. And that can be difficult. So I'd like to ask if we're willing to move epidemic and economic modeling from being added bonuses to argue for a priori preferred policies or interventions to being essential tools to assist with making the best choices and allocating resources. And if we do, what will it suggest we do differently?
Thank you, Dr. Merman, and thank you, David. So I think we're going to open. Do we have time for a few questions?
Yes, I think so.
So if anyone would like to come forward and ask a different question or comment on some of these questions that we thought were really critical to summarize at the end of the conference, we have time for a few questions.
I guess the cheese stands alone or something like that. I think these are some really great questions. Is the microphone working?
It is.
Okay. And in particular, I appreciated a lot of the questions you were asking, Dr. Merman. In terms of leveraging the current healthcare system to maximize the impact of these great interventions that you were talking about, including PrEP and PEP and condoms and all of these other things, I think it's very important. We ask a lot of communities that are highly at risk to change their behavior, to take these up. I think we ask a lot of community-based organizations to, you know, improvise in spite of not very much funding. But I think that we also need to put a lot of pressure on physicians and healthcare settings to make them safe for people to have the conversations that they need to have. And I know that in the U.S. in particular, we don't do enough education around LGBT health in medical schools. And I think that that's something that we could put a lot of pressure on in order to make sure that we're investing in safer spaces for people and really combating stigma. So I just want to put that comment out there.
Hello. I'm Ralph Womuth from the Arkansas Department of Health. Over here.
Hi, Ralph.
Now that we have begun to fully embrace PrEP for HIV prevention, I'm curious as to whether CDC is having any serious discussion about PrEP or post-exposure prophylaxis for prevention of other sexually transmitted infections.
So, Ralph, I'm always looking for innovative and creative ideas, so I thought maybe we should just put everybody on either azithromycin, although we've got the mutant gene for syphilis, and that could, you know, that would have covered chlamydia too, or doxycycline. We'd even get some chlamydia benefit for treatment of syphilis. The challenge is bacteria are different than viruses. Antimicrobials are different than antivirals. And we are on the cliff of the possibility of resistant gonorrhea. And I do not want to be at the CDC as an infectious disease doctor and leave when we have no drugs left to treat gonorrhea. So I think it could cause more harm than good. So at the moment, I kind of put it into a good idea, maybe, but I have real concerns. So I think we've got to come up with some other innovative solutions that aren't going to have other unintended consequences like we're seeing with some of our great HIV prevention strategies that now seem to be having unintended consequences to the burden of STIs.
Well, I know that that's happening in the community. Some folks, just like some folks, started initiating their own PrEP for HIV prevention before it was embraced widely. Some folks are embracing post-exposure prophylaxis for STD right. in the same way.
Right. I think, well, just to add on, I think there's the concept of trying to, again, look at new interventions and thinking ones that will make it kind of that are easily done and could be effective is important and on target. There are two issues that come up when I think about your question. The first is that is related to what Gail's saying, that taking antibiotics, you know, antimicrobial agents, on a regular basis, as you would for PrEP on a daily basis, that has untoward effects on your body flora in a way that tenofovir emtricitabine doesn't, because it's specifically focused on retroviruses. So there's, you know, there are other issues that make you more susceptible to other infections, diarrhea, potentially respiratory illness, and other things. So there's one, in addition to just the public kind of question of whether it would increase resistance, I think more just for the individual, we would have to document safety. The second issue is that most bacterial STDs are treatable. And so getting diagnosed, it may be a simpler mechanism than taking the prophylaxis, because the balance between the potential toxic effects of the prophylaxis compared to just getting diagnosed and treated, it may not balance out for some. I appreciate the thought.
I also think your point raises the urgency with which we need to get money into STI vaccine research. Really, it's very poorly funded. We lack a sufficient number of the immunologists getting money to work at a very basic level. And there was an excellent symposium at the very beginning of the conference on STI vaccines. And so I think that's another thing we really have to push for, to get people to put money into STI vaccines.
Thank you.
Hi.
Last question.
So I work with congenital syphilis stuff in South America, and can you? And you know, for us, the pregnancy and Pap smear is a way of screening women both for that stuff and just as having a filter and a control for women. But we don't have anything like that for men. And I was wondering if you have any thoughts about the implementation of some kind of something to get men, so it's not just symptomatic diagnoses, if you guys have any ideas about that.
I really like your question. It's been plaguing me for some time. In the reverse, I've wondered if HPV vaccines are implemented universally and truly we start reducing to negligible levels the risk for cervical cancer, are women also going to stop pap smears, in which case you end up having the opposite problem. Well, then I don't have to come in every year. So I love the idea of thinking, what are the routine things that we can tag on to that would enable us to continue providing people with important STD screening and diagnosis and treatment? I don't know the answer for men. I think there are people who've thought that that concept of men's health and maintaining men's health has been lost since the 1970s when it first started. And really, what does it mean to do that? I also think that we can think more carefully about what is a routine service. I mean, right now, if you go to the doctor, you do get vital signs checked, and often you're weighed. And the question is kind of, you know, what, and clinicians are inclined to do at least a lipid check every 5 years. I mean, there are a few things that are done. And the question becomes, how do we incorporate that so that even if men aren't coming regularly, they're coming regularly enough to get some of what you're saying. But unfortunately, I think you joined into the custom on this podium right now of asking questions that can't be answered.
Yeah, and if I may just come in on the men's issue as well, I think it's also a question of where we should be offering those services and should they be in clinics, because a lot of men don't like to go because they're worried about getting labeled as HIV positive, certainly in high prevalence areas. And I think the best person or the best group to ask is the men themselves. And, you know, we've done some work, Jamie and I worked in South Africa asking men at bus stops and various other settings in Alexander Township. And you get a very different story when you actually ask the men themselves. So maybe we should spend a little more time with our qualitative behavioral questionnaires to answer that question.
It looks like we have two other quick, anxious questioners. Go ahead.
I'm going to make a rather counterintuitive comment that I think that sex currently, at least in the wealthier countries, is the safest it's ever been in history. Think about it. There are fewer people dying over sexually transmitted diseases now than have ever occurred. There was a rather interesting paper written by an economist, published, I think it was the Archives of Sexual Medicine, a couple of years ago. And he pointed out, he did some modelling juggled the sort of CDC statistics and so on, and showed that the epidemic of bacterial STIs that we experienced in the second half of the 20th century was in fact triggered by penicillin. When people stopped dying from syphilis, there was a pause of about 10 years, and then we went at it like rabbits again. You know, for the 400 years before that, the cost was too great to have... there were social breaks, if you like, because your risk of dying from syphilis was so substantial. And Americans, for example, had died at a similar rate from syphilis for centuries, as happened in the peak year of 1994 with death for AIDS. And that was just the peak year. It was only a peak year. It was a spike in our history. We're seeing exactly the same now. You don't die from HIV anymore. There was a bit of a pause for 5 or 10 years, and we're just seeing the brakes come off again. Purely because sex is safer now than it's been throughout our history. Thank you.
Thank you, Basil. Case, one quick question.
Well, actually, comment. I had two comments, and one comment, one suggestion. The first one had to do with Ralph's comment earlier about PrEP and PEP and so forth, and I just wanted to point out that I don't disagree with your statements about PrEP, but PEP we've been doing in STD control for a long time, and treatment as prevention, ironically, is also something that we've been doing for a long time in STD control, so it's kind of interesting that we are finally turning the corner with HIV. The suggestion that I wanted to make, I couldn't help but notice in the slide that Dr. Merman just showed, there was the logo of Safe in the City. He didn't mention it, but it was there, suggesting that it is a very efficient intervention. Indeed, it is a very efficient intervention, as we have shown. And actually, we're working on a Safe in the City type of video for HIV treatment adherence, but it's really high time that we should think about doing more videos for the Safe in the City intervention, since the video that is still being shown, by the way, around the country is now over 10 years old.
Great. Thank you, Case.